sort of Christmassy.
Easily thing. Available on
yes, it is.
DVD
it,
or maybe
or
we
YouTube.
Hope streaming.
I think YouTube might have it because it's one of those that was in public domain.
Yes. Well, I'll briefly mention mine, which is scary in a certain way. It's called Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley Kubrick's last movie, and a lot of people don't like it. But the more I think about it and watch it, the more I grow to really appreciate how tense it conveys our world of human sexuality and how nervous-making and uncertain it is, and at this, you know, this man's journey through the night. So Sight and Sound just dedicated a whole issue to it last month. But so that's a little bit more grown-up than other films.
So
but
Eyes Wide Shut,
Eyes Wide
March
Shut.
Of the Wooden Soldiers, The Story of Temple Drake.
That's right. And this has been DK Home with Fortunato.
Hey.
And this is Film 11. I hope you get to hear us next week.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Today I'm speaking with Professor John Chaney Lippholt, author of We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. Welcome to the Digital Divide, John.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I found your book frighteningly relevant to our, you know, day-to-day online living that we do. So you kind of really cover these two areas that can seem disconnected, but it was really informative and educational in reading the book. It also spawned a lot of questions about our lives. So the first thing is I looked up the word algorithm. I said, you know, I want to really understand, you know, kind of the academic meaning of this word. And the Google definition gave me a process or set of rules to be followed in calculations or other problem-solving operations, especially by a computer. And your book is about the data that's collected about us and how it can be used and how it's used to create a, like a personality, you know, another self, an online self that other people use. Do I get it? Did I get
that,
it?
That's more or less the exact same way I would probably define it. I think that the idea of an algorithm as a kind of a technical definition is the best one we have, but a lot of people have also thought of it as a recipe, that when you follow a recipe, you are really thinking like a computer, which is you follow each line, and then you complete it, and you go to the next one, and then when you have your cake done, you know you're finished with it. But instead of a cake, for example, you might get a credit score that's a certain number, or maybe the NSA thinks you're a terrorist because the algorithm thought through the data that you produce that you were more terrorist than not, and so you now have the, I guess, the horrible fact of having your data be seen to be an enemy of the state.
Can I ask you a question about that? Is that how some people end up on the don't fly list who don't belong there at all?
The don't fly list is actually even more rudimentary. Often it's not even about one's metadata, like who they call or who calls them or even where their phone is. Often it's just because somebody has a name that's similar to an alias. Sometimes a lot of people who are wanted by the U.S. government have like 21, 22 different aliases. And so if you are on that list in one of those names with that has a person who has an alias that is wanted by the U.S. government, you are probably going to be on the no-fly list.
How unfortunate to end up in a situation where you're dependent on proving you're who you are and that you're not someone else.
That's actually, I think, really the irony, or at least the paradox of the book. It's that often we know who we are very well. We know how we feel, what kind of identities we inhabit. But when our data is used often against us or for us, the algorithmic interpretations about our data are rarely, if ever, going to be accurate. Or even if they're not accurate, or even if they are accurate, they're probably not going to be talking about the same thing. So for one of the examples I use in the book, I invite your listeners right now to do this too, is you can Google, what gender does Google think I am?
So someone would go to Google and they would type in the search bar, what gender does Google think I am?
Precisely. And then there's going to be a link that shows up, which is connected to your Google ad preferences, that will suggest your age and your gender. And for example, I'm in Google's world, a 65-year-old woman. I am a 30-something-year-old man. But the idea is that Google's age and gender is not trying to talk about age as how many times you revolved around the sun, or gender as, you know, how does your lived experience in your body embed itself within regimes of patriarchy or regimes of sexism. Rather, it's, do you buy like a 65-year-old woman? Do you surf like a 65-year-old woman? And it turns out, I guess I do.
I want to read an excerpt you posted on Robert Scheer's website, TruthDig. And by the way, shameless promotion, I'll be interviewing Robert Scheer again next month for our July episode, and we'll be talking politics, so be sure and tune in. All right, shameless promotion over. But here's your excerpt that you you did an article on the Truth Dig, and people can look that up. And you wrote, when a human being becomes a set of data on a website like Facebook, he or she is reduced. Everything shrinks, individual character, friendships, language, sensibility. In a way, it's a transcendent experience. We lose our bodies, our messy feelings, our desires, our fears. It reminds me, you wrote, that those of us who turn in disgust from what we consider an overinflated liberal bourgeois sense of self should be careful what we wish for. Our denuded networked selves don't look more free, they just look more owned. And my reaction, I went, more owned? Tell us how.
I think that that's really, I guess, yeah, the idea of the book too. It's that when we're defined by somebody else instead of ourselves defining who we are, then we're at the whim of what the person or algorithm or whatever institution identifying us wants us to be. And so when Google determines my gender, or when the NSA determines if or if not I'm a terrorist or a citizen, that it doesn't matter how much we might scream into the computer, no, I really am a citizen of the U.S., the NSA algorithm that determines our citizenship based on who we talk to, where IP addresses are pulling from, what kind of language we speak, even if we encrypt our communications, that's actually what matters. So we have the right to privacy if our data suggests we're a citizen and the NSA algorithm determines we're a citizen, but we lose that right to privacy even if we're U.S. citizens if our data is seen algorithmically to be foreign. And so in that way, we really lose who we are because we're owned by the NSAs or the Googles or the Facebooks of the world.
At least our online interactions are owned by that.
Precisely. And as I argue in the book, too, that increasingly more and more of what we do is going to be tethered to that online identity so that we might have, yes, this offline presence, but as we have more and more connections to the digital world, those are going to have more and more influences on what our rights are and what our resources are accessible to.
I think a lot of people have experienced that. In particular, I know we're talking a lot about Facebook, but Facebook is such a phenomenally, you know, well-used platform and an amazing, it's an amazing tool. It's for free. Anyone can use it. And it does allow people to really connect, but there's more. At least now there's more. So let's kind of back up a little bit for our listeners. And if you can explain how our data or our algorithms are used online, I think that'll help us.
Totally. So let's take the example of Facebook. And Facebook, when you log on, you create a profile. It asks you voluntary questions like, what's your zip code? What's your gender? What's your date of birth? And then it gives you the ability to like certain things, to be friends with certain people. That data seems to be piecemeal. It seems to be very basic and kind of one-dimensional. And so in that, we can think, okay, we're just giving ourselves, Facebook knows who we are because we told them who we are. But then Facebook did something a little bit more, I guess we can think, ingenious, is that they said, what if we started to model certain identities, such as ethnicity, and figure out, what are people who are Hispanic? What kind of stuff do they like? What kind of friends do they have? What is the behavior of somebody who's Hispanic online, and how is that different than somebody who's Asian American or African American? And so what Facebook did is exactly this, and they created something called an ethnic affinity, which also people can check if they Google, what is my ethnic affinity on Facebook? And it will show them with an ethnicity that is based on nothing but the likes that they've done and the information that they posted on Facebook. Again, that has no connection to their body or to their own heritage, just on the behavior gleaned from the data that they produced on Facebook.
So we have data, let's back up, we have data, and the websites that we use, they collect as much as they possibly can through, you know, email, IP addresses, what we like, what we click like or don't like. How about our search terms, like when we use Bing or Google or Yahoo to search?
So that is very telling, too, because with something like Google, you do have, again, your search term. I'm searching for soccer, let's say. But Google's tracking not just that I searched for soccer. They're tracking what site I came from to go to Google, what site I'm going to once I click on a link, what time of day I search for soccer, and what kind of computer. Is it a Mac or a PC? Does it have a really big screen size or does it have a smaller screen size? Is it using a certain browser? Does it have certain languages and certain fonts installed? All of those things which we think would have nothing to do with soccer are then used in order to both profile users on Google in this case, but also to give you a certain variation of what kind of searches you might be interested in. So ideas of relevance. So for example, if you use English as well as Spanish on your browser, it's going to give you English as well as Spanish results. If you use only English, you're only going to see English results. And so because of this, yeah, as you mentioned, there's so much data that's out there, but often what has to happen, it has to be collected. And so Google has one of the most extraordinary surveillance assemblages, we can call it, these kind of great networks of different things connected together, so that not only is your Google connected to your Google profile, but your YouTube habits, your Google Map habits. Any web page that you go that has one of those Google icons on it that allows you to put it within your Google Circles or your Google Plus accounts. Google, in kind of a very, very, very generous sense, they have more or less control of about 20 to 25% of the internet, not because Google owns it, but because the data that you visit when you go to different sites often feeds back or, quote, phones home to Google, so that they're tracking you not just across Google servers, but across the internet in general.
That's phenomenal. you've also mentioned like data brokers. Who are they? What do they collect, and who do they sell it to? And how do they get the information? Do they buy it from someone else and then resell it?
Yeah, so there's this kind of mantra that people have been using, which is that oil was the 20th century, that data is now the commodity of the 21st century.
It's like plastic. So it went from plastics to to the oil to the base product. Now it's nothing tangible, it's just data.
It's just data, and so now it's almost, there's no scarcity, but the only scarcity, I guess, would be the ability to get as much data as possible, so whoever has the most data thus has the most valuable data. So data brokers are people, or more or less institutions and organizations, that try to buy as much data as possible. This is data that they buy from Google. This is data that they buy from other ad agencies or ad analytic companies like Quantcast or Audience Science. And they take then also publicly available data like census records or voting behaviors or motor vehicle and driving records. And they connect it all together into this gigantic data set. And with that, they algorithmically process to produce new ideas of people, new demographic identities, or new what they call psychographic identities that think not through I'm a woman or I'm a man, but I'm compassionate or I'm vulnerable. And through that, they then sell that information, and especially those kind of like algorithmically produced categories of identity, to people who want to sell ads to people, or people who want to do maybe political targeting. So a campaign like the Trump or Clinton campaign would hire a bunch of companies to then bring them data so they can target the most, the largest, and I guess the most direct and definable category of voter.
One thing I heard you mention in an interview is that your credit score and other aspects of opportunities can be affected by who you hang out with online. So would this be a possibility that if you have friends who, say, just as an example, defaulted on student loans, could you be penalized with higher interest rates when applying for credit because your friends might not have high credit scores?
That is precisely what can happen. In fact, Facebook has purchased a patent that would do exactly this. The idea being that Facebook and credit scores in general, they're not really interested in you as a person who has a history or an identity. They're interested in you as a potential consumer, or in the case of a credit score, somebody who's going to be a high risk or a low risk user. And so what that does is it says that, you know, maybe somebody has an amazing credit score and they pay back every loan and any credit card that they have, but they have a lot of deadbeat friends. So they have a lot of friends who pay their credit cards really well because they're paid way too much money. All of that stuff then has some sort of influential idea on who you are that's not necessarily connected to your capacity to pay, but in terms of how computer models understand people, social networks are extraordinarily influential on determining behavior, as well as determining, you know, how likely somebody is, I guess, to pay back a loan or to have good or bad credit.
So in terms of, you know, that's that addresses, you know, being eligible for credit. So how does our online data or online personality, how does that make maybe airline tickets that you and I both want to buy, that the price that might come up during a search, your price might be different than my price for the exact same flight at the exact same moment?
Yeah, this was, for me, one of the most kind of phenomenal examples of the issues with algorithmic processing in this way. It's in 2014, for example, Orbitz would bring would show you higher prices for plane tickets or hotels if you had a Mac browser or if you had a larger computer screen. So recently, Uber has changed their pricing algorithm, so no longer will prices be allocated according to distance and time, which is normally what these ride-sharing apps use. Now, since Uber, a company like Uber, has so much data, they're able to do machine learning to figure out what geographic places and also what kind of users are more likely to pay more for certain routes than somebody else, and due to that, you know, data, they're able to actually charge users more for an Uber route than they would charge others, just precisely because they have this, you know, large quantity of data that tells them that X person is wealthier than others. This is notorious in offline markets and what we normally think of as asymmetrical information markets, where the idea of the lemon car came from, which is a used car salesman on a lot sells you a car, looks wonderful, but the carburetor is broken. But the thing is, you don't understand that the carburetor is ruined until 2 miles after, when you drive the car off the lot, it falls apart. The idea being that the used car salesman has a bunch of information, you had little information about the product. That relationship is actually being mirrored online when a company like Orbitz or a company like Uber has so much information about you, but you have little to no information about how they're allocating prices or even what other people are paying.
Yeah, I don't see that working out well for them in the long term.
I hope not, but increasingly this is the way that a lot of...
Some lawyers are going to get rides in Uber, and they are going to be like, compare what they charged and, you know, the rest of the story.
Well, that's the thing. Is that it's entirely legal. It's just that there's some ideas of transparency that are at the kind of, you know, because you by acceding to the Uber's terms of service, you are more or less saying, Uber has complete control over what I pay. They have complete control over my data. That it's a precarious place, but it's also legally also very gray, as you mentioned.
Interesting. Well, one of the things I was watching, I think I was watching a slideshow that you had given on a talk, and I love how you compared, this is for all the Harry Potter fans out there, you compared to Harry Potter's use of the magic map to track his friends with how geolocators work. And would you explain that for our listeners, especially for the Harry Potter fans?
So there's a lot of, I mean, the fact that we have phones that often most of us, or a lot of us, carry around at all times,
yep,
is a very convenient thing, but it's also a tracking beacon. And so a lot of companies are able to follow people around based not on you saying I'm in X place or in Y place, mm-hmm, but because your phone is at that place. So in the magic map that Harry Potter has, the scene scroll, that is this kind of mythical idea of somebody being able to understand exactly where somebody's friends are, exactly where somebody is in a building. That is becoming completely real and completely not mythical in how our GPS data is phoning home every second, where our data is, where our phone is, where we are. And thus, you're able to produce this extraordinary map of where you go over time, and that information, I think, is one of the most private things that we could possibly think of, that where you go, who you're with, how long you're with them, where you spend an evening, where you have dinner, all of those things you would think are something private to you, but because our data is available and because that GPS data is then potentially sellable, that really the idea of like going to your house, closing your door, and having a night home with nobody paying attention to you, nobody looking, nobody watching, nobody caring about you, that's seemingly a day that's long past.
Right. Now, I know that at least on the iPhone, and I assume for other models and brands, that it is possible to turn off the geolocating services for specific apps and programs, but the phone itself, I believe, has a separate geolocating system. So it is possible. I don't know if it's effective. You know, I don't know if it's just designed to make you feel like you're in control, that you can turn off the geolocation feature for specific apps so that those particular apps are not necessarily following you around.
That is definitely correct, that you can go into your preferences and change it. The iffy thing, though, is that often every time you update an application, it reverts to the default settings, and the default settings are on, yeah.
Yeah, and you have to go back and redo it all.
Yeah, or even online, imagine like you can go online, and every page you go to, there's like 10 or 11 different companies that are watching you and tracking, mm-hmm, you across. And you can theoretically opt out of each and every one of those.
Sure, you can turn your cookies off, and then you you're going to be hating life online.
And that too. And also, they can still figure out who you are based not on your cookies, but based on the very kind of like unique thing that your computer is, which is, you know, some people have a lot of fonts installed, some people have a different screen size, mm-hmm, some people have a different thing. That if you take all of the data that your computer gives, you can actually figure out who a person is without any identifying information, but we have enough complexity and difference in our data of our computers or our browsers that is able to identify, yeah, again, a single, unique, individual person.
So this question might seem a little way out, but I don't think it's that way out. So have we lost the ability to conclusively refer to our non-digital selves, our flesh selves, as real? Like, is it possible that our online selves can be equally or even more real, whatever that means, you know, than our physical, real world, three-dimensional selves?
I honestly think that's one of the best questions we can ask, because it's not far out, because I think it's the most applicable question we can ask of technology. Is this technology making me less like myself, or is this technology taking me away from who I think I am? I would actually wager that increasingly our digital selves are not more real, but they're more useful for companies or for governments. And so by being more useful, no matter how real we think we are, if you go to a bank and you say, hey, I want a loan, they'll look at your credit score, they'll look at your information, and they'll say no or yes based on your data, not based on how persuasive you are or how much you smile, mm-hmm. or maybe even how well you dress. And so in that way, I would think that the things that have influence on our futures are increasingly our data, and I would think that that would make it more real than, you know, how we would normally think of ourselves, or how normally we would want ourselves to have power to change our futures. But as we've all probably experienced in an airline or, you know, online trying to access something, it doesn't matter how much we scream at a computer or even if we, you know, complain to a flight agent, that it's the data eventually that has the last laugh or the last capacity.
So how would our digital profiles ourselves be different, or, you know, from our three-dimensional physical selves? Is it just all about consumption? Is it all about buying and spending and selling?
Well, that's the kind of weird thing. Is it within this stage of late capitalism where everything is about buying and selling, the data that people care about is, how do you make somebody buy more? How do you make somebody sell at a lesser price? So it's based on that, yeah, commercial logic, though there are a lot of nonprofit or university researchers who are trying to figure out how to use data for other maybe non-commercial purposes. There's a couple people who I've recently been reading about that have tried to create a watch that will track your mood over time. This is compelling in a kind of like, yeah, like a
mood watch.
But it's also kind of terrifying, because mm-hmm. you can imagine a company looking at that, and once you are sad enough, they'll give you an advertisement for anti-anxiety medication.
Right, or would that information be used against you, or somehow used, you know, in a job interview for, you know, a job application, or for, you know, important life changes that, whereas, you know, what you were tracked as 10 years ago or 5 years ago, people can change. They don't frequently, but they can, or they can, you know, embark on new endeavors. And it seems that, you know, this process of, well, here's a question. Can I, you know, have the same data profile about myself that other companies are selling? Like, where can I get one?
I think it's a really good idea, and there's a lot of artists who do this thing that they call a data audit, which is that they take all the data they can purchase and find and then explore what it means and how that's wrong or right. Increasingly, though, I think that there's something really useful in thinking about just the crazy size of this data market. Data, especially like online advertising, is an $83 billion business with thousands of different companies, of which those have thousands of different data sets with thousands of different interpretations of what those data sets mean. One company might think you're a woman based on the data that you've produced. Other companies might think you're a man. Other companies might be unsure. The actual consequence of these is rarely about creating a unified, this is what John is, this is what X person is, and rather creates a layered idea of who you are. So you could theoretically, yes, figure out what your data is and run algorithms to make sense of it according to what the patterns of gender or race or class are, but that would just be one of a thousand different layers that constitute who you are and how you're seen online.
Fascinating. How does law enforcement use all of that data? Do they have access to the same information that the data brokers do?
That's I think, one of the most terrifying things. There was an example of Facebook, who gives access and sells a lot of data through, you know, GPS as well as profiles, that there were law enforcement buying data about Black Lives Matter protesters in New York City especially, and they were able to track them across, you know, platforms from Instagram to Facebook and to Twitter. And so because of all this data centralized, and it's because it's a commodity, anybody can buy it, including, yes, the New York Police Department. Other police departments, like the Chicago Police Department, are using data in what they call predictive policing. This idea is that you take crime data over several years, and you can figure out what city blocks are high crime, what city blocks are low crime, and even more, what city blocks are high crime at a certain time and day, and how they change over the week or over the month. And through that, they can maybe allocate different police resources to those high-crime blocks. But the Chicago Police Department took this even further in 2013 and started to, like we were talking about earlier, connect it to not one's person but to one's social networks. And so somebody, not a city block, but a person, was seen to be at risk if they had a lot of friends who were either victims or assailants of violent crimes. So now it was not you who was actually at risk. It was the fact that your friends were at risk that made you at risk. And because of that, the Chicago Police Department would actually come to your door, knock on it, and tell them that they were watching you because your data suggested you were likely to commit a crime or maybe be a victim of a crime.
Wow. Wow. That reminds me of a movie I saw once.
Yeah, Minority Report.
That's
right?
The one, right, where, you know, the law enforcement are, you know, using, I don't know, special people to alert them when before a crime is committed, and then they're enforcing against an individual that they think is going to commit a crime.
Yeah,
before it happens.
There's extraordinary racial bias in these because the people who have already had connections to law enforcement, the people whose data are already in the system, are going to be disproportionately people of color. It's obviously, you know, when you have that asymmetry, it's just going to reproduce it. There are other examples of law enforcement, or at least the criminal justice system, using data so that, for example, a case in Wisconsin in 2016 and 17 came up where a judge used an algorithm called Compass, which means just correctional offender management profiling for alternative sanctions. Whatever that means is usually used for recidivism and parole, but it's a dossier of different questions and, you know, ideas of, you know, what kind of gender, what kind of zip code, what kind of date of birth this person has, and then runs it through an algorithm, and then the algorithm will suggest to a judge or to a parole officer how likely the person is going to commit a crime. And there's this guy, Loomis, who stole a car several years ago. He was actually given a 6-year prison sentence in part because this algorithm suggested that he was likely to commit more crimes than other people.
Wow.
This same algorithm, for example, though, in 2016 was the subject of a ProPublica investigation where they found that it was extraordinarily racist, extraordinarily anti-black, and thus was, you know, perpetuating white supremacy, but in a way that people didn't recognize because it was just seen to be a computational algorithm that was neutral and objective.
That is horrifying.
It's for me one of the most kind of like problematic things, precisely because a lot of people see data as accurate or they see algorithms as being without human interference.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a very good slogan that I constantly have to think of, which is that there's no such thing as raw data, meaning that there's no data that comes untouched by human interference or untouched by human bias.
Right. So for, you know, just regular folks searching the web, looking for information, maybe where to get awesome dumplings in Portland, are there penalties for searching privately? You know, browsers now seem to have a feature where you can say, they even ask you, do you want to search privately sometimes? What does that mean? Is that effective? And if you do that, is there a consequence?
So it's a really good question because increasingly there's this sense of security, because on your local machine, if you do incognito or you do private browsing, it is not saving any browsing habits or patterns, and it's also not accepting cookies or any other of the ways that people can be tracked. And so in that way, there's a potential to be penalized, because sometimes sites require you to use browser cookies, require you to enable JavaScript. So sometimes if you use private browsing, you're not able to be as participant in the web as normal. But at the end of the day, there are ways, and these companies have spent millions of dollars to try to figure it out, to track you even if you have private browsing on. So it might be a good way to avoid maybe people in your house or looking at your computer from surveilling you or knowing what you're watching or looking at. But for these companies, or for especially for governments, they've long been able to track people across different places, even when people are trying to be hidden or not found.
Good to know. Well, so what about search engine sites like DuckDuckGo? Is it the same thing?
DuckDuckGo is one of those, I don't know the idiom, one of the diamonds in the rough for a company or a site that has been intentional about privacy, knowing full well that there's this mission creep, that once you have a little bit of data, you look to your finances, you're like, we can make some more money selling this, and you start doing it. That DuckDuckGo from the beginning said that they're not going to sell data, they're not going to collect it, they're just going to be a search engine, and that's it. So in that way, those sites are extraordinarily useful, but at the same time, they're not Google. They're not able to compete with these, half-trillion-dollar companies that are there in order to, invade your privacy and in order to take your data and make it useful for purposes of capital.
So one of the slides that I saw you present in this talk that you were giving, and I'm not sure that what I saw was what I think I saw, so I'm going to just throw it out there.
Please.
You were talking about, the networking cables, like the physical cables that, data from the internet is moved back and forth over. And you had a picture of a cable and a connector and wires, things I don't really know very much about. And then you said something to the effect of that the NSA had added some machinery, some equipment or cables to these channels that allowed them to not keep the data that was moving, but to make a copy of it and then send the copy to themselves. And I think that was one of the most alarming and surprising, and maybe I'm just so naive, I shouldn't be surprised, because of course they can do that, but the fact that if that's what I really understood to be happening, I'm still surprised.
I think there's something to a lot of this stuff that, as baffling as it is, as much as you try to study it, it's going to keep on surprising you.
Did I get that right?
You totally got that right.
Oh, no.
the notion behind this is that a lot of laws that are regulating intelligence agencies like the NSA, which is that they're supposed to not surveil anything inside the borders of the United States. So anything outside is fair game. Anything inside is illegal and unconstitutional. The problem with the internet is that often a search from Portland to Ann Arbor, where both of us are, might go through Canada, or it might go through Mexico, or even might go through Dublin and then come back to Ann Arbor. There's no, because it goes to the speed of light through these fiber optic cables, there's no necessity to go directly to something.
And underwater.
So what happens is that, you think about the infrastructure and it makes sense, but you don't really think about it when you're making a search. When you search for something in Japan, for example, it is actually going under the Pacific Ocean through this cable that everybody else's traffic is going through. So there might be 100 or so cables around the globe, and what the NSA does is it puts actually a piece of glass into these cables. They might have somebody get into a scuba suit and go about a kilometer offshore to do that, and then they're able to copy everything that goes through that tube. And then in doing so, the NSA was able to, or at least documentation several years ago said, take the entire internet, all of the traffic that's being sent and collected around the entire internet, and save up to 3 days worth of it. So NSA analysts were able to take these 100 different cables that were tapped, put it all towards a central database that is now likely going to be south of Salt Lake City in this gigantic data warehouse that the NSA has, and able to search and scour through the records of everybody more or less over several days and potentially now weeks. So this extraordinary amount of data is really, really useful for the people at the NSA because they might want to track where people were and who they were talking to. But for somebody like you and me, they're actually taking all of our data as well, from our emails to our video chats to even to, you know, where our cell phones are as we make searches on Google or on Bing.
But wait, we don't spy on our own citizens.
You scoffed. That for me, it was when the 2013 Snowden revelations came. It was a really big bombshell for a lot of people, and this is not to be, you know, arrogant, but for people who are studying it, the technological infrastructure of surveillance in the U.S. over the past decade after 9/11 was so just laughably unconstitutional that it wasn't surprising, but it still was, to the extent that people were surveilling people in the U.S., it was surprising. One way that this became constitutional or became legal was one of my favorite algorithmic examples, which I alluded to earlier, which was in 2009, Eric Holder, the Obama administration Attorney General, he signed off on what he called minimization procedures, which were ostensibly procedures that gave the NSA limits on who they could surveil and who they couldn't. But just like it's really difficult to understand who somebody is online, they have to rely on huge swaths of data and algorithms to understand them, the NSA couldn't figure out who was a citizen because nobody surfs with a passport or a birth certificate connected to the computer, that they instead created a new algorithmic citizen that the NSA was able to surveil so long as somebody wasn't 51% confidently citizen. They could surveil people if they're 51% confidently foreign. So that idea of citizenship or foreignness was based on a citizen is somebody who speaks English, doesn't encrypt their communication, never vacations or leaves the United States, never talks to anybody outside the United States, doesn't have anybody who's a friend on a Facebook or on any other site.
That's outrageous.
It's completely ridiculous. And so because of that, they're able to actually legally use this idea of reasonably believed to say, I reasonably believe this person is not a citizen, even though the data is coming from within the United States, because Google's cloud servers are located in the U.S. as well as in Ireland, for example. So
right.
If the U.S. is trying, the U.S. security state is trying to get an email from somebody, they're necessarily going to have to go into actual U.S. land or U.S. territory to get that information.
Is there any kind of defense that an average citizen can use to say, you violated my privacy, I demand a refund? Or, you know, what do you do?
It is one of the most important questions, precisely because...
Yeah.
How do we understand who we are? How do we get a sense of freedom in this world of ubiquitous surveillance? There's several different strategies people can use, one of which is a little bit iffy because it's an actual U.S. government-produced program. It's called the Onion Browser, or the Onion Router, called Tor. This is what people like Edward Snowden suggest you use, and what it does is it says, instead of going from your computer in Portland to Google, it takes three or four different servers and tries to anonymize your traffic with three or four different proxy servers. This is kind of like when, during Watergate, Bob Woodward would go from DuPont Circle to Roslyn, Virginia. He wouldn't take one taxi because then if anybody from the FBI would find him,
right,
they'd know exactly who he was. So instead, he would take one taxi, get out, take another one, get out, take another one. And so if any taxi driver was interviewed, they wouldn't be able to tell the whole story.
Mm.
This is kind of helpful, but at the same time, it's still valuable. There are other strategies that suggest you encrypt your communication, which is useful, but there's also one that is one of my favorites, which is called obfuscation, and there's a browser that you can download called TrackMeNot. What this does is it says that most invasions of privacy happen because you have data that looks like a terrorist or looks like somebody who's of interest or looks like something that they care about. What obfuscation does is it sends six or eight different random queries to every search engine a minute. And by doing this, it produces a lot of chaotic, random noise.
Noise, right. Conflicting data that it can't make sense. I can't make an algorithm out of that.
Exactly. So your ostensibly authentic real self producing, you know, I'm trying to order dumplings in Portland, that's going to be completely dominated or collapsed by six or seven different queries every minute that ask for random stuff that would have nothing to do with you, but would, yeah, completely befuddle an algorithm trying to find a pattern of who you were.
I'm Rabia Yemin with The Digital Divide, and we are talking with John Chaney Lippold today, the author of We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. What's changed since you wrote this book? Because I can imagine, you know, writing a book takes time, and all these technologies and processes, and they keep happening while you're writing your book. So what's changed since your book came out?
That's very interesting, because I've been doing research for this book for over a decade. And so as something as quick and as change and dynamic as the internet is necessarily going to confound a lot of the assumptions or arguments I had, I've been very pleasantly surprised at how a lot of the stuff I wrote several years ago still keeps going, though now it's just more refined. I am surprised by changes that have happened with companies who've gone over what I would think would be ethical lines. The most recent would be leaked documents from Facebook that say that they're actually profiling teenagers, not adults, but teenagers, and trying to see if they're depressed, lonely, or vulnerable, and then sending that information to advertisers who want to target lonely teens. The idea being that that's a consumer market just like anybody else. But I do think that there's something, when we treat everybody like data and everybody like a commodity, we really lose out on what we're doing to people and how we're maybe potentially affecting them, their emotional states, or maybe their futures as they kind of get enwrapped in all of these datafied assumptions or suggestions or inferences.
It is kind of like the Wild West of data out there. You know, I can easily see, you know, based on information in your book and what we've talked about, you know, how people can be discriminated against, how, you know, if you're posting that you're sick today, that, you know, maybe your insurance rates are going to go up if you're lucky enough to have insurance next year. And like you said, well, I can say for myself, there have been a couple of occasions recently where I went to go on the internet, maybe check my email or something like that on my desktop, and had been thinking about maybe a purchase, okay? Like a very specific type of purchase, a specific kind of product. Maybe it's a rug, maybe it's a lounge chair, something like that. But I haven't searched for it. When I go online, they're offering me an advertisement for that. And that's where I'm really saying to myself, now, wait just a minute. How does it know Deck Lounge or Chase Lounge? How did that happen?
That's, I think, one of the most compelling...
Has that happened to you?
It totally has happened to me. And the thing is, though, something like Amazon, is that they're collecting so much data. It's not just you might like a Chase Lounge. It's we should show her that lounge chair at 6 p.m. because we know that she's more likely to purchase stuff after work than before. Or we're more likely to show it to her on a Thursday because that's when she's more tired and more likely to make an irrational purchase or a purchase she's not planning on making. That they have that data, and so they're very savvy on how they place advertisements, but also they're savvy in when and exactly, you know, in what context those advertisements are going to come up.
Do they have access to our financial data?
They can buy, with these data brokers that you mentioned earlier, they can buy that from a company that sells it and figure out your credit score or maybe how much money you have in the bank account or maybe even what your salary is if that's going to be publicly available.
You've been warned, everybody. If you're going online, and I had, you know, read in your book about the Facebook, you know, like the user, the terms of use, mm-hmm. The user agreement. We all just click on that and we're like, yeah, click. I'm just going to use this. I'm not doing anything. I'm not even reading that. And I think that's probably true for almost everybody. And if you do try to read it, do it right before you go to sleep at night. Going to put you into a wonderful slumber. You know, there is a trade-off. There's, you know, a company offering us the use of their tool for free, and this we're just using this as an example. I'm not in any way promoting Facebook. I use it, but I'm not suggesting that anybody listening do that. So it's not a promotion, but we can't pretend or deny, you know, how large and extensive this program is used by everybody, by so many people. And so when you sign up, you're agreeing to whatever the terms of service are. You're saying, I'll sure take everything you can glean about me, and I'll use your tool for free, and then we're both getting something.
Exactly, and the almost kind of disheartening thing too is that they can change it without telling you.
Mm-hmm.
And so no matter how much time you spent reading it the night before, over the evening and when you wake up, it could be completely different. And since you continue using the site without reading it after, that you've indirectly acquiesced and accepted to those new terms, even though you weren't alerted of them.
Right. It's like a passive agreement.
Exactly.
In a way. Well, so if we use services like DuckDuckGo or private browsing, can we be penalized? Does that make us look suspect in the eyes of law enforcement? You know, does opting out and kind of going underground or saying, no, I don't want you tracking me, is that, you know, does that equate to, well, you must have something to hide?
It honestly does. If you encrypt your communication, it highlights to government agencies that you are likely somebody who's, again, trying to hide something. So they copy everything that's encrypted and save it into a database. In the future, hope that they'll be able to decrypt it. If you go to the Tor browser's page,
mm-hmm.
the government will flag your account because it sees you as trying to evade the government dragnet and thus somebody who is necessary to watch. A lot of these sites, yes, if you try to show some sort of freedom, that it will be a highlighting kind of piece of data for those agencies that are interested in, you know, maintaining national geopolitical security and, I guess, imperial dominance.
I mean, I can see this going to the Supreme Court. I can see someone saying, like, I have a right to privacy and you're violating it. But
I sincerely hope it does, but increasingly with what you were talking about with the terms of service is that without any public ownership of these companies or without any public ownership of the digital spaces that we inhabit, we are entirely vulnerable to the corporate confines of a Facebook who decides everything, decides the rules, and in the terms of service, those are the de facto constitution. So we're using the site for free, but in doing that, as you mentioned, by having it for free, we're paying with these things, and so our legal recourse is blunted, if anything.
It's a lot to chew on, that is for sure. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Digital Divide.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves by John Chaney-Lippold. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.